supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Many of us probably know long-term married couples who are still in love, and then we know those who say they have grown apart. And after many years together, often raising children, some couples end up forging new pathways together, while others see divorce as their best option. Especially as Americans are living longer, some long-term married couples are calling it quits in search of someone or someone else, and maybe a new lifestyle, something perhaps they dreamed of for many years. So what's the secret behind why some long-term marriages last, and at the same time, what is it contributes to their breaking up, and what happens to people after they do end long-term marriages? Well, joining me in the studio to talk more about this is Dr. B. Janet Hibbs. She's a psychologist and family therapist here in Philadelphia. She's the author of Try to See It My Way, Being Fair in Love and Marriage. Welcome, B.
Thank you, Dan.
Welcome back,
my pleasure.
I should say. Later in the show, we'll hear from writer Rachel Simon. I had a chance to talk to her about her relationship with her husband, Hal. They were together for 13 years and decided to go different ways, only to come together 6 years later and get married. And she's written about her experiences using the metaphor of rebuilding her house in her book called The House on Teacher's Lane, a memoir of home, healing, and love's hardest questions. We'll hear from Rachel later in the show. In the meantime, we would love to hear from you at 888-477-9499. If you're in a long-term marriage, tell us what works. If you're in a long-term marriage and are considering leaving or have left, we would love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. And there's one other group we want to hear from you. We want to hear from adult children whose parents have decided to call it quits, and what it's like for you. We're also tweeting today's show at twitter.com/WHYY. B, let me begin by getting the bigger picture here. What triggered this, of course, and the most surprising divorce in recent years has been Al and Tipper Gore. They were married for 40 years, and they seemed to get along quite well. And at the end of the day, they said they had grown apart. What does that mean?
Dan, I think that part of what you're seeing today and what may now be called the greatest divorcing generation are people who married in the 70s, like the Gores, who offer what I call softer reasons for getting divorced. We've grown apart. We're not meeting each other's needs. We're not, soulmates. And so reasons that I think would have been unheard of in their parents' generation are now becoming, more and more frequent. And it's not the high drama reason that we often think of. Oh, someone had an affair, or there was cruelty. It's in stable marriages that get to their ruby anniversary. There is often, if you look at the bigger picture, that particular age cohort was caught between what is thought of as the companionate marriage of up until the 1960s, and then the more individualized marriages, which began with more expectations of equality and more emotional expressiveness. And those expectations began around in the 70s and 80s.
And that was around the time of the women's movement.
Right.
That was all the movements of the 60s, which started with civil rights and wound up with personal rights.
That's absolutely right. Yep.
So this generation, you say, is the graying divorce, and those numbers really are increasing. We'll talk about that. But this is also the generation that was the highest divorce rate ever in the 70s, where we reached 50%, maybe even over in the highest. Mm-hmm. And it's down now since then.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the generation that got caught in the middle.
This is the age cohort, and I think it's important to recognize that people who married in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, I think had different expectations for what marriage would provide, and they are not divorcing at the same rate as those who were married in the 70s.
What do you mean different expectations? Seems to me that their expectations for marriage almost climb. Go get higher and higher.
I'd say at one level, they've definitely increased in terms of our expectations today for having a more emotionally supportive partner, for having more equality in terms of spouses helping with childcare and even both earners. But part of what the age cohort in the 70s experienced was, I think, as we all do, we look at our parents' marriages and we bring our expectations from our parents' marriages to inform us about what should we expect from a husband, what should we expect from a wife, what should we expect in terms of help or support emotionally or financially or otherwise. And so that generation caught in the 70s was informed by their parents' marriages, which were much more traditionally defined, as opposed to today's marriages, which are, really more an aspect in many ways of a notion of self-development, that your spouse is going to help you develop.
Yeah, and the problem with today's marriages is we look to our spouses to provide more and more, and we expect them to be best friends at a time when our social support networks are diminishing. There's lots of studies that show that both genders are having fewer and fewer intimate friends with each succeeding generation.
I think the pressures on today's marriage are enormous, as you're indicating. And I think people sometimes forget that it's in the first 10 years of marriage, even though that only accounts for a quarter of all marriages, it accounts for half of all divorces. And in part, I believe that is due to the fact that people have unrealistic expectations for what their spouse should provide, and they overburden a marriage with those expectations that often are unreasonable and are going to, unfortunately, lead them, if they divorce, to change partners, dance the same dance, and especially if you get in a marriage with young children, children have more consequences even than adults do.
Hmm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about marriages in later life, how they stay together, why they break up, and the fact that the number seems to be growing. They're still small, they're about 8%, but it does seem to be growing for what you call graying marriages.
Right.
My guest is Bea Hibbs, a psychologist, family therapist, author of Try to See It My Way, Being Fair in Love and Marriage. If you want to join the conversation, please call early because I have a feeling we're going to be backed up later in the show. Our number is 888-477-9499, and we're tweeting at twitter.com/WHYY. If you are in a long-term marriage, give us a call. Tell us why yours is doing well or not doing well and what your thoughts are about the future. Bea, I wonder about how our longevity plays into all of this, the fact that we're living longer.
I think it's very important for people to remember and to even frame their thinking by the fact that today's rate of marital dissolution is the same as it was 100 years ago. It's just that today, you can't count on your spouse to die. Because 100 years ago, spouses used to die before they reached 20 years of marriage. On a fourth of the time, women died in childbirth, men died in agricultural and war. So there were basically, on the one side, you know, the divorce rate today means that we expect to live longer and healthier lives. And so we have a second or maybe even third adulthood where we say, gosh, you know, I have another 20 years to live. I think I'll be healthy. Do I want to live it this way with this person?
This is Margaret Mead.
This is Margaret Mead.
Talked about that where she said there are three marital cycles, you know, one for romance and one for child rearing and one for later in life when the children are gone. And she observed this in the animal kingdom. So, you know, I wonder if there's something kind of hardwired in our evolutionary genetics that, you know, have us shifting at these three stages in life. This is where the divorce rates tend to
spike,
peak, don't they?
I think that they do peak. They peak around year 5 to 7 in early marriage, which might be the young romantic marriage that Margaret Mead's mm-hmm. talking about. Then they peak around year 18 to 20, which is, okay, the kids are no longer quite so young, and now we can manage more on our own. We don't necessarily absolutely need a partner to help us raise the kids. And then we're seeing a third peak. It is, as you say, a small but significant rise in marriages where, okay, now the kids are out of the house, and now we have each other again. So I do think that, you know, as I say to couples who are trying to stay married, the deal keeps changing, and you have to learn to renegotiate the deal so that it works for you as you are changing roles.
And the argument back to growing apart, that dreaded phrase,
yeah.
But you said the deal keeps changing, and what growing apart usually translates to in my office is that one person has changed over the course of the years and the other may have done so much less.
I think that's often true, and that's certainly what people report. I think, again, the fundamental problem is that what the person who, let's say, is evolving at a different rate may not have clued the other person in, and the other person, I often find, is shocked and sometimes devastated by the, you know, perhaps the announcement, hi, this isn't working anymore. And what I often encourage people to do if one of them reaches that point is, one, look at why they're vulnerable, look at why the marriage is vulnerable, and then have some period of discernment because perhaps more is possible.
Let's go to the phone. We've got Rita on the line.
Hi,
Dr. Rita.
Karen, I'm a huge fan.
thank you
for taking my call. I've been married 23 years, and it's been a roller coaster ride. And my feeling is that I think when you make a commitment to someone, such as in a marriage, you know, I think that many times people go into it with different expectations, like you were talking about, and sometimes people think that, well, if it doesn't work out, I'll just bail out of it. But if you go into it with the expectation that you're getting into a relationship with someone for life, and that means through all the changes, you have to have a certain amount of flexibility. You have to be creative, and you do have to recognize that it is going to be difficult. It's not easy all the time. So I hope that when people do get married, that they take that into account and think about the fact that, you know, you're marrying this other person who's just as scared as you are, who's going to grow and change just like you are, and you cannot expect them to be someone that they're not. They are who they are, and you either love them or you don't love them for who they are. And I think that's the reason we've been together so long. It hasn't always been easy, but we talk about it. And as I've grown and changed, I keep him informed of where my beliefs are changing or shifting, and well, we always keep something in common, and that's important. I've seen too many of my friends just stop hanging out with each other, stop exploring new things together, and they end up growing in different directions, and they're not interested in the same things anymore. So you know, if you have one basic thing that you're both interested in, like with us, nature, we're always interested in doing something for the environment, camping, anything that has to do with being outdoors. So we're always exploring those areas together and bringing our kids up to experience them as well.
Well,
but you have to, the expectations are the most important.
Expectations are everything. Having something in common means a great deal. And we're going to talk later in the show, Rita, about not just having something in common, but finding new things to have in common, too, to help keep boredom at arm's length, which can be pretty dangerous for marriage. Rita, thanks so much for your call. I appreciate it. So, B, a lot of it's about expectations. We don't expect marriages to run into hard times, so we're not prepared when they happen.
I think it's important for people to recognize that all long-term relationships, whether they're marriage, whether they're parent-child relationships, whether they're partnerships, are going to have problems. And I think part of what Rita's saying is so true, which is that, well, at the first sign of trouble, you can hit the eject button, or you can slow down, you can say, okay, what needs to go better? What responsibility can I take? And, you know, unfortunately, I think part of what happens in American culture is we have two opposing values. One is marriage. We're the highest marrying population in the world. We're also the highest divorcing population in the world. But the other value is individualism. And so when we have the notion of, oh, well, you know, here's another opportunity in my life to examine, am I happy? Well, every opportunity we have, we're not going to come up with that answer, yes, I am.
You know, you called us the highest marrying country in the world and the highest divorce rate, but both are going down. The marriage rate is going down, as is the divorce rate, and there's probably a relationship between
that,
the two.
That is true. The marriage rate is going down in part because marriage is now not the first step you take to announce you're an adult. It's really pretty much the last. So we're waiting until our late 20s oftentimes to marry. And I think also what's happened that's very different in the last 40 years is that in 1960, only 8% of people cohabited. Now it's closer to 50% of people have cohabited and have multiple partners before they have a marriage.
Hmm. When couples decide to break, when they're graying, who is it that's more likely to end the marriage and why?
I'm going to break this down into categories. In an otherwise stable marriage, it's women, because they often, for the reasons of basically saying, I'm tired of putting up with someone who's mean or controlling. I don't want to spend the next 20 years of my life this way. And they file for divorce more than half of the time. However, when the gender bias is somewhat different in terms of the reasons men give, men often give reasons that have to do with I'm not getting enough attention, and or they have had an emotional affair with someone, or perhaps an affair outside the marriage, and they have the notion that they can have a happier life with another person.
How do they do?
Each person.
Do you know?
Oftentimes, people do, because we're the most remarrying country also, they do remarry after a divorce. I think women are somewhat more realistic, and I always tell people, only separate or divorce with the notion that maybe you're going to be alone, because that's the only thing that you can, you know, guarantee. But I think many times the hopeful news is that people who have learned from their own responsibility taking when they're getting a divorce, they can have a more fulfilling life, even if they're alone.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to hear from Rachel Simon, but I also want to hear more about what couples can do to prevent this scenario, and there's lots they can do. We're talking about graying marriages. What happens to marriages after 20, 30, 40 or more years? Why Some stay together and seem to thrive. Some stay together and seem to stagnate. And why so many seem to be ending after a long term. My guest is B. Janet Hibbs. She's a psychologist, family therapist, author of Try to See It My Way. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We'll get to more calls right after our break. That's 888-477-9499. If you have left a long-term marriage, give us a call. Or if you're in one and are delightfully happy, tell us your secrets. We'd also love to hear from adult children whose parents have divorced when they were adults. And again, our number is 888-477-9499. And you can tweet with us. We're twitter.com/WHYY. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Barnes Foundation proudly supports WHYY and presents its art collection, open to the public extra days this summer during its final year in Marion. Featuring wall-to-wall paintings by Renoir, Cezanne, Matisse, and art from around the world. Now open Wednesdays through Sundays, 9:30 a.m. until 5 p.m., with special programming throughout the summer. More details at barnesfoundation.org or 610-667-0290.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Linda Greenhouse, author of Before Roe v. Wade, about what led to the landmark Supreme Court decision on abortion. She says public discourse didn't begin with feminists and the emerging right-to-life groups.
It was an issue that was put forward by the public health community.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with Dr. B. Janet Hibbs about graying marriages, why some stay together after many, many years, and why some end in divorce after long term. Our number is 888-477-9499. B, some researchers at Stony Brook University in New York have done some interesting brain scans studies with couples. They found that couples who do new and challenging things together are happier than couples who do the same old things. And, you know, that's what keeps brains healthy anyway, but boredom is a big factor.
Boredom is a big factor, and I think the couples, as Rita was talking about, you know, having something in common and also finding new things. That's actually why, why people fall in love. They're discovering all these new things. They're being introduced to new things by another person, and we forget. We get in a rut, and we forget. Oh, you know, we still need to do new things even though we've been together a long time. So sometimes what I've suggested to people in long-term marriages is take turns. One person one weekend is responsible for coming up with something new and different that maybe the other person wouldn't ordinarily do, but they know they each get a turn to propose something and try something different. Hmm. And that's often, you know, very appealing to couples who get more stuck in a rut and kind of no one takes responsibility for saying, let's try something different and new.
Well, B, that sounds great on paper, but there are a lot of people, especially as we age, that find comfort in sameness. And, you know, one point sameness gives us comfort. You know, it's like being in a groove and being in a rut.
Yeah.
And how do you know when one turns to the other?
Well, I think that it's in some ways all about balance. I absolutely agree that part of the comfort and security in being in a long-term marriage is knowing what to expect so you're not on a roller coaster, because that takes a lot of emotional energy and is draining. But I do believe that the balance is between, you know, that comfort and also finding, you know, just fun things to do that would be, you know, a new experience.
So there's a risk here that one spouse is bored or both and maybe not even know it. And then after 20, 30 years, look back and say, my God, I have been bored for 20 years. I've got to get out of here. What can be done to, you know, stave that off? What are some questions we can ask ourselves?
I find that part of the vulnerabilities that marriages run into, I think that there's often a precipitating event prior to people saying, I'm bored with you, parenthetically. And the precipitating event often is a threat to mortality. It's that can be your own, it can be a spouse's, it can be the death of a parent, because you no longer have the the parental approval and reinforcement for your marriage that maybe you had for many years. And so I often think prior to people declaring they're bored, I often look for a precipitating event that has led to the discovery that they're bored.
That's interesting. We've got lots of people who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Chuck. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hi, doctor. I'm currently going through one of these divorces. I'm about 30, and my parents just got divorced. And I have siblings who are much younger, they're younger than me, and they're having an extremely hard time with seeing my dad dating and seeing my mom going out and getting her own condo and having a hard time adjusting to the idea of parents being out. And I'm looking for any advice you may have on how to help my siblings with my parents dating.
And both parents are dating. Let me try. We've got a really bad connection, Chuck, but let me just ask you one question before we bring you down and see if it can come across clearly. Are you there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's it like for you?
For me, I'm actually happy for my parents because I've seen them have difficult times in their marriage during my entire life, and so to see them being willing to take a step out into the community, I'm happy for them. I'm for my mother a little bit. I'm happy for both of them that they're
okay.
Making a change.
All right. Well, we're gonna have to ask you to take the rest of the answer offline because our connection's not really good. But thanks so much for your call, Chuck. So here we've got two reactions. You know, we've got one child who's actually happy for mm-hmm. their parents, and I have heard mm-hmm. that often.
Right.
It's a sense of freedom, especially for mom. And now we've got younger siblings who are distressed. Who's more likely to be distressed, or is it universal?
When the caller talked about being somewhat relieved and happy, when you witnessed a parent's hostile relationship that's been ongoing for years, if not decades, it often is a relief to a child, even an adult child, to say, finally, you know, one of them has hit the eject button, if not both of them, and they're going to have a life that is maybe not as hard or stressful. And honestly, the statistics from researchers are that if you're in a truly hostile relationship, health-wise, it's bad for you. On the side of the younger adults, the siblings that Chuck's referring to, you know, part of what I think parents don't recognize, we think divorce only affects younger kids, and that's true, but part of what's really hard on kids is seeing new partners introduced. Kids don't want to have to relate to a new partner. And I often encourage parents, keep that part of your life separate unless you've somehow decided this is my future partner. Kids, sorry, you're going to have to get used to it. But, you know, kids are too old beyond about the age of 9 or 10, to be interested in a new partner. Plus, it's a threat to their relationship. They lose their parent in some ways to the falling in love stage where they're not, their parents aren't as focused on them.
I want to bring up the interview I did with writer, author, Rachel Simon. Like I said, she'd been with her husband, her partner at the time, Hal, for 13 years until they split. They spent 6 years apart. They got back together, and they've been married for 9 years. And, you know, they're rebuilding their relationship. They actually renovated a home together from start to finish. It's a fascinating story, and the book is a great read. The book where she wrote about it is called The House on Teacher's Lane, a memoir of home, healing, and love's hardest questions. Like I said, I recently had a chance to talk with Rachel about her experience. Rachel, I know you're not an expert on long-term marriages, but like everyone else, you're an expert on your marriage. You and your husband, Hal, have been married twice to each other.
The first round, we didn't formalize it. We are people who have two discrete phases in our relationship, one of which might as well have been a marriage because we lived together for 13 years, and then the second one is an actual marriage, and that's been going for 9.
Did you actually break up after 13 years?
We did, and we were totally apart for 6. So it's like the river Styx. We had to cross over it. Although then we didn't get to Hades. We got to the promised land.
In your personality styles, you and Hal are very different. I mean, I learned about Hal from your book, The House on Teacher's Lane, but I know you personally, and I know stylistically you are a worrier and a planner, and you are filled with a ton of energy, and Hal is a Buddhist.
Yeah, he's a much quieter person than I am. I'm real social. He's very content to come home from his architecture job and sit in his studio and write music. Whereas with me, after a day of writing, I'd like to see friends or go out and about.
When you broke up after 13 years, what brought you back together?
When he came back into my life, we had both changed a lot over the 6 years.
How so?
Well, one thing that happened during that time was that I had a very intimate and ultimately public experience with my sister, who has disabilities, and which I wrote about in my last book. And as a result of that, the big transformation I had was learning how to accept people in their totality rather than as a series of checks on a checklist. And I had changed in other ways as well. I had come to embrace compassion and respect much more than I had before. And he had changed in a lot of ways as well. So when we came back together, we'd had compatibility when we were younger. But this time, because of the respect and compassion and acceptance that I had learned, and I think because of the Buddhism that he had taken on during that time, we didn't actually get back together. We started a different relationship because we were different people. And thinking about it that way, which was true, it meant we didn't kind of have to clean things up. It just meant we started clean, and that's how we proceeded.
I wonder if you hadn't broken up and forced yourself to stay together longer, if you ever would have gotten married.
We would not have. We would have slogged along somewhat unhappily or maybe very unhappily until one of us finally pulled the plug. And we both acknowledge this and that it was terrible, terrible to go through the breakup. But if we hadn't done it, we wouldn't be in this very happy marriage that we're in now.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the book, House on Teacher's Lane. You talk about how you and Hal completely rebuild your house together, which is interesting because renovating a kitchen can destroy a marriage, and let alone rebuilding an entire house. So how did you do this and stay together and not kill each other?
I think one of the things that really helped us is that we'd already broken up. So going through the renovation was, in a way, celebrating the mending that we had been doing. There were also very practical reasons. Hal was the architect on the job and could explain things to me, could help diffuse my anger with his Buddhist ways and his knowledge of how things worked in the building world. And also we moved off-site, which he was wise enough to insist we do.
So with all of these things in place, we were able to proceed. I think there was one other component that was very helpful. We knew how to do the dance of life preferences together as a couple.
What do you mean?
We knew when to say, you lead, I'll follow. Now I'll lead, you follow. Something as simple as picking out fixtures for a faucet, which, frankly, I don't care about whatsoever, but he had preferences about, and fine, he can pick it. I don't have to. And I later found out that when people have their meltdowns working on a house, it's because they both want to be the leaders. Neither of them wants to be the follower. But I think part of the magic of what makes a marriage work is that you just kind of learn, and now I'll follow and I'll let him lead, and now he'll let me lead and I'll follow. And that's what we did.
One of the things you imply throughout, Rachel, is that when you stop trying to change Hal, things changed for you. That's easier said than done. That's kind of a process. It's not a decision. Or is it?
Part of it was a decision. When we first broke up, I was in my mid-30s, and I felt like a complete failure and very upset with myself because I came to realize rather quickly that my whole idea of what love was boneheaded and was based on Hollywood mythology, this big, world-changing, soul-melding love. And somehow, as part of that, I thought that we had to be like each other. This had really stuck in my craw through those 13 years. So when we broke up and I realized how foolish I'd been in my whole conception of what a relationship was, which I think is something a lot of people go through when they start to grow up, I realized that I needed to kind of start like an apprenticeship and observe people who were in long-term yet also happy marriages and figure out what made it work.
And?
I had a revelation. Hal didn't have to be like me, and I didn't have to be like him. I had to respect him for being different.
That gets to another issue that you brought up in your book, where you said being in a marriage is more than just loving and being committed to someone. You went on to say it means acting on your commitment.
Yes.
So what does that look like?
Sometimes what it looks like is if the other person says something that bugs you, you have to remember the importance of unity over your own sense of pride. I think it's the pride that really gets in the way and that keeps you from saying, you know, that thing you just said, it hurt me. And you have to, in a way, decide, I'm going to be courageous and I'm going to say, that hurt me. And you also have to be courageous and put things aside and know when to shut up and not bug the other person. And it's learning to do this dance of love and learning when to say, okay, you know, this is what he needs to do, or now I have to step forward and be very proactive. I think the key is that love is a verb, and you show love by speaking and listening and doing. And sometimes it's really hard because your pride gets in the way.
You said a critical aspect in sustaining a marriage is about forgiveness, and certainly it is. That's another one of those things that's easy to talk about, but really difficult to do.
Just being very, very conscious. The fact that we lost everything together is very helpful because we can go back to that. Learning the tools for reaching out to each other is also very helpful. And when you have been together a long time, you can sort of use shorthand to say things like, now we know not to argue that way, you know, and I have to really be incredibly simplistic about it. If you're going to say to yourself, I'm going to apply forgiveness or compassion, respect, all the rest of that stuff, that you have to be very conscious.
That was writer Rachel Simon talking about how she and her husband Hal rekindled their relationship after being 6 years apart. So, B, you know, I'm watching you over there listening to Rachel, and you're kind of nodding knowingly like the old professor or Yoda or you know, a mother figure here. So what was going on in your mind while you were listening?
I thought that she had come upon a truth that often comes out as a joke, which is you can be right or you can be married. So she had made a decision. She called it not being prideful, you know, not having to win, in essence. But she had, and I think one thing that people often, you know, kind of don't see is there are multiple decisions in being committed to another person. And part of them is the decision to take another person's perspective and learn from it.
A very simple truth here, that peace doesn't come when you win a battle,
right,
or even a war.
Yeah.
Peace comes when you stop fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that she discovered. Bea, we've got to take a short break, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. We're talking about marriages after 20, 30, 40 years, why they stay together, why they come apart, and what happens after they come apart. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're hoping to get right back to the phones after our break. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'm talking with Bea Janet Hymns, psychologist, family therapist, and author of Try to See It My Way. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
All this week from NPR News, coverage of the Senate confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Join me at the end of each day for a one-hour summary of that day's proceedings with analysis from NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. That's coverage of Elena Kagan's confirmation hearings all this week from NPR News.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Kevin Eubanks had a successful career as a jazz guitarist before The Tonight Show called. And now, after 18 years on TV, he's left to return to music and expand his repertoire.
I just want to play heartfelt and passionate music. To me, that's music, whatever name you want to put to it.
We'll see what's next for Kevin Eubanks next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about long-term marriages, what keeps them together and why they fall apart. The divorce rate for long-term marriages is still quite low. It's still around 8%, but it really is climbing. So why is that happening? We've been talking about it with Dr. Bea Janet Hymns, a psychologist, family therapist here in Philadelphia, author of Try to See It My Way. And let's go right to the phones. We've got Rick on the line. Hi, Rick. You're on Voices.
Yeah, thanks, Dan, for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the program. It's a good one. I want to thank you for doing this. I wish a lot of young married kids were listening to it. But for me, I've broken down what works for a marriage into five basic ingredients. First one is a common faith. I think if you can build on a common belief system, you build on a foundation that supports trials and tribulations. A cord of many strands or three strands is not easily broken. Communication is the next one, I would say. Trust is the next one. Humor, absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is such a thing, chemistry. And I just would like to say that I got married on an R&R. In 1970, I was an infantryman in Vietnam, and it's been 40 years, so something's worked.
Well,
and it's just been a fabulous marriage, and I would just offer those ingredients to your listeners.
Well, you know, I'm listening to your wisdom and your comments, and I got bad news for Bea Hymns, because the next time we do this show, I'm bringing you on.
I'd be happy to come on. Let me give you my phone number. It's
2-1. Whoa, no. Well, thanks so much for your comments. I'm anxious to hear Bea's thought.
I'll listen to her off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
I think that Rick is on to something. I think those are really key ingredients to have a long-term successful marriage. And, I think that they all help. I would say to people who don't have the common thread, you know, as Rick said, of having a religion be very important, you do lose, you know, the institutional support of a community that upholds marriage. But it's not the only factor that upholds marriage, because actually even people who say religion is very important have a slightly lower, but not that much lower, divorce rate.
He also talked about not just religion. He didn't mention that word, but a common belief system.
A common faith.
A common faith. And mm-hmm. too many people don't talk about that mm-hmm. in marriage. Like, what is your belief about how the world works, what it means to be human, what relationships and marriage mean? Those kinds of big philosophical questions. And those are wonderful conversations, especially early in marriage, but repeated.
That's really fascinating. I had taken the concept of faith and gone to the religious aspect. But yeah, faith also has to do with what we value and what our traditions are and the other kind of commitments that make us slow down when things get rough.
Yeah, he also mentioned something else that I think is critically important. My parents were a little bit nuts. I don't quite know how to say that. They were wonderful people, but they were neurotic and anxious and cranky and all that. But their beauty was they didn't take themselves too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could play with them, mm-hmm. about them, about their minds, and we could always laugh. And he said humor is a key. And, you know, I wrote a chapter in one of my books about, you know, my belief that if there were more than 10 commandments, the 11th would be thou shalt not take thyself too seriously. I think self-importance is dangerous and humor is critical for marriage.
I think it is absolutely crucial, and there are some neo-Freudians who say, hey, he got a lot right, but he left out play. And yeah. the ability to play with your partner in terms of humor, in terms of just enjoying the everyday is very key.
Yeah, well, Sigmund wasn't a really playful guy anyway. Let's go back to the lines. We've got Bob on the line. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. What can we do for you?
Okay. Actually, Dan, I've been married for 37 years. I appreciate you taking my call, but I've found that I think long-term marriage has a lot to do with the ability to rediscover the intimate and fun things that brought us together in the first place. And the second point I'll make is that I think the early retirement offers that are out there for couples are going to devastate marriages, because I see so many of my friends jumping on this ship to take early retirement, and they financially devastate themselves, and all of the fun things that they wanted to do later in life, all of a sudden they can't afford to do. My wife and I have gone from very top of what you consider life and finance to the very bottom and rebuilt that. And in 37 years, it's just a wonderful thing to be able to stay married and face all the challenges.
That's just a terrific point. Thanks so much for calling. I want to hear your thoughts about.
I think that he is right that money certainly always puts, or it's one of the top factors that people cite in getting divorced, and so. You know, having money troubles, whether it's by early retirement or whether it's just by the economy, as it's been in the last couple of years, certainly puts a strain on people. You know, not blaming the other person, trying to be supportive, being kind, being appreciative of things that are within our control is one of the things that we can do to keep ourselves going.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can squeeze on one more phone call. We've got Laura on the line.
Hi there.
Hi, Laura.
Hi. You touched upon talking about what marriage means to each other, and I thought that was really important. I'm in my early 20s, and I'm in the process of talking about getting married with my boyfriend, and marriage means two different things to us. And for me, I don't feel like I need marriage to prove to other people our love, but I think that's something that he feels like he needs, and I feel like I want marriage as a security if I'm going to have children or if I'm going to you know, just to know that the other person's there, but I don't feel that I need it this young in life. And he feels like he wants it just to show other people. And I don't think that's the way to go.
I would push you, Laura, to push him to see if that's the only reason he wants to be married. If it is, then there's some questions there, and maybe even some problems. But I have a feeling that might not be the only reason that
right.
he wants to be married.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, we're absolutely, you know, in love with each other and know that we want to be with each other forever. But for me, knowing that and promising that to each other verbally is enough. I don't feel like I need, you know, I don't need the ring. I don't need the piece of paper. But he feels like he does need that. And I feel like for him, we're going to have to do it. But, you know, I don't feel like I need it.
Well, you might want to talk to him about his family of origin and expectations he's carrying from his family and expectations you might be carrying from your family. Unfortunately, this is a long discussion that I wish we could have, but we just can't.
And it's a great one.
Because we're running out of time. All the best, Laura. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Yep.
Well, like I said, we are running out of time. And my friend, B, we have run out of time. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
For joining us. It was a wonderful discussion and an important one. And thanks to my listeners. Thanks for my callers. And thanks for my tweeters. So my guest today has been Dr. B. Janet Hibbs, psychologist, family therapist here in Philly. She's the author of Try to See It My Way, Being Fair in Love and Marriage. Earlier on, we heard from author Rachel Simon, who's written The House on Teacher's Lane, a memoir of home, healing, and love's hardest questions. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, you can email us at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Check out my new webpage. It's just been completely revised. I'd love you to visit me there. And our archived editions of Voices are at whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for today's show's been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Stephanie Marutis is our producer. Evan Pliss is our intern. And Matthew Block is WHYY's social media intern. And he tweeted on today's show. Thank you, Matthew. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.